This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe. I hope everybody had a good week. I hope you're relaxed, and this is going to be a very interesting interview. So just relax, sit back, have a glass of your favorite alcohol or your favorite adult beverage, and we'll get the next guest going. Tonight we have Mr. Anthony R. Page. I know Anthony from years ago and have been following his career for a while. He's very special in that he's a producer, director, he's a writer. He has a company that he calls Blue Bistro Creative, and creative he is. Tell me how you evolved into this. If you don't mind, though, Anthony, I just want to tell the audience a little bit about my history with you.
Okay.
In 2006, I met Anthony Page, and it was the 50th anniversary of James Brown's 50th anniversary in Hollywood. There was a big celebration in Augusta, Georgia, which Anthony Page actually spearheaded. I was working with Lucinda Clark from Poetry Matters. That's her company. And I painted a couple of portraits of James Brown. And Anthony was instrumental in getting artists from all around the world to come to Augusta, Georgia, or send their work to Augusta, Georgia, as we depicted what we felt was visual soul. So that's a long time ago, wasn't it, Anthony?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it was outstanding. So you've evolved since then. Tell us about Blue Bistro Creative, because I know that you're doing filmmaking. You're doing a lot of different things, and I want you to share it all with my audience.
Well, I've always been a creative kid, but, you know, growing up in the South and kind of not quite rural, but kind of on the borderline of a rural type community where there's a little bit of shopping centers and stuff like that. But it wasn't like a really big arts town. It was a manufacturing town, you know, the Augusta, Georgia area. So there wasn't a lot of cultivation of that creativity. But when I finally came to Atlanta in 93, I just lit up. And all of those creative things that I wanted to do as a kid just fired up. And I didn't want to limit myself. So I dabbled in music and visual arts, and I studied dance, and ultimately acting was where I put most of my attention. And that grew into directing, producing, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I do today. I'm most of my time, you know, producing and directing for film, television, and theater, mostly independently, because much like Tyler Perry says, I'm working to build my own table as opposed to plugging myself into a Hollywood system, so to speak.
I think that's a really outstanding aspiration. And I think that's something that many creatives do, or should do, because I think that's my opinion, that it's the best way, because then you don't have your creativity stilted. I couldn't help noticing when I was looking at your background on the internet, especially on LinkedIn, you were involved with the International Black Theater Summit, and it's tied into what is Black Theater Day. It's tied into a few different things, and you're involved with the Billie Holiday Theater and the Kraft Institute. How do you get all of these different entities to be cohesive?
You know, I stay involved with social media and that kind of stuff. I'm not directly involved with them, but as a theater professional, they were launching this campaign to kind of create what they would call National Theater Day. Black Theater Day. So every year in September, they want to celebrate Black theater, Black storytelling in that format. So with some of the projects that I've done in the past, I decided to be a part of that campaign and promote it on social media. So I basically took their press release and posted it and shared it out and kind of made sure people within my reach, you know, had an opportunity to kind of celebrate the day or be aware that there is a day and look forward to kind of hoping and seeing it grow over the years. So I don't want to be a misnomer. I'm not directly connected to the Billie Holiday Theater nor the Kraft Institute. But as a theater professional, and a theater producing body, I wanted to be a part of, you know, they invited theater professionals across the country to participate in their social media campaign. So I did.
I think that they should be very happy to be connected to you.
Well, thank you. I'm just here just trying to do my thing. That's all.
Well, you all, I know you as a galvanizer. And so, that's a very positive thing to me. Not everybody is a galvanizer. I've seen your work. I've watched your work. I've been part of it. So Black theater has become I don't want to say it's a trend, but Black theater, I know for a fact is becoming more and more recognized. It's getting more recognition in the theater arts. I guess I kind of know it because during COVID, I was very fortunate to be involved with a couple of performing artists, Black performing artists, who were taking the bull by the horn and doing their own thing. So how did the pandemic, because I know we spoke a little bit before this interview about how you had some things scheduled and then all of a sudden then COVID happens and you had to put a lot of things on the back burner. How did that affect you?
Well, you know, let me kind of explain my business model. About a third of my business is client-driven multimedia work. You know, I put together pitch deck, graphic design, some photography, editing, that kind of stuff. So all of the multimedia client work is a good income generator for me. Another third of it is doing live events, you know, other playwrights, you know, invite me to come in and maybe help produce their work or direct their work. So that's another third of activity. And the other is independent film work, commercials, anything video related, directly where I'm producing, directing, and writing for the most part. For 2020, I had 8 live events planned. When COVID hit in March, they started falling like dominoes. All 8 events got canceled. And I was a bit concerned because I'm like, oh my gosh, there's my year. And then long story short, all of the multimedia stuff started going up because so many people, since they were at home and quarantined, went into planning mode for their next steps. So they needed pitch decks, they wanted press kits, they needed to update this and update that. So there was a lot of work for me at that time. And then a few people had written scripts and that kind of thing. And then, you know, actually film production actually increased, even though we had to jump through the COVID protocols, you know, making sure everybody was tested almost daily, mask. And because we did one they call SAG, you know, which is the Screen Actors Guild. COVID productions was SAG sanctioned, meaning we had to follow SAG protocols. We had to test almost daily. We had to have certain spacing requirements on set. We had to have a health representative, that kind of thing. So it all kind of tied in, and that part of the business just really grew, but we were able to function even with the big question mark of COVID, you know, around. So I was excited because, again, when those 8 events got canceled, I was a bit concerned.
I could definitely imagine. I think it's really commendable that you kept certain protocol, you adhered to certain protocol with regard to the health issues that you had to deal with. You know, we've heard some things in the news about Hollywood and how different entities are dealing with it.
I mean, for a number of reasons, I have a complete vested interest. I am now vaxxed and, you know, I was going to get vaxxed no matter what. I know some people are skeptical about that, but my wife is high risk. She has a high risk health issue and we didn't know how it might affect her. So she was completely quarantined. And then I have an 11-year-old son. And I didn't want to bring anything to them. So when I was functioning in that COVID reality, I was very, very cautious because I didn't want to bring anything home to them because they pretty much stayed, you know, in our little bubble. And I was the one that went to the grocery store and got the gas and kind of took care of things so they wouldn't have to put themselves at direct risk. And I you know, I wore a mask and I had the alcohol and the sanitizer and all of that kind of stuff. So I kind of held it down for them for a while. So when I went on set, it was no joke for me because I was like, I'm not playing with this thing. And unfortunately, there was a number of people that I knew personally and it was pretty close to me that passed away. There was a friend of mine who her son got sick from COVID and she was trying to nurse him through the process and he died.
Oh my gosh.
3 weeks later, she died.
Oh my God.
It's no joke. And she was an actress that I'd worked with in the past and it's no joke. Now, I think, you know, people continue to play with it and got all of this. Yeah, I don't play with it. I don't want to get too political, but yeah, I don't play. I'm very cautious and very safe where we conduct our business. So
it kind of is ironic in a way, considering that during this year, we've dealt with COVID, we've dealt with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. That's why Black people need to get vaccinated. All people need to get vaccinated because everybody's life, your life matters. I'm sorry that you had to experience the loss of people that were close to you. I think I don't know anybody that hasn't experienced that, but it doesn't make it hurt any less just because everybody has experienced it. I have to say that the theater in New York was definitely affected by it, and they're getting ready to open again. How is the theater climate in Georgia right now where you are? How do you see changes? What changes do you see since the beginning of COVID?
Oh, well, here's something that I found to be interesting. A number of my theater colleagues, it seems that time in quarantine, they were incubating a lot of stuff. I think people, since they were at home, they weren't out and being social as much, and a lot of things are shut down. They started writing and outlining and developing characters. So I expect to see a surge of some really phenomenal activity, you know, once live events are just full on. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is that many theater people had got innovative. So things like Zoom and using streaming services to maybe bring an experience of theater to a different audience, which is interesting because it doesn't limit you. You know, if you do live theater, people have to be in that city and in that building. But, you know, with Zoom, it just opened up some possibilities. And I think people are starting to develop some new business models out of that. Not completely getting away from the in the space, in the room, but, you know, a hybrid where there's some part of what they do that could be broadcast via Zoom or some sort of streaming mechanism. So I think it forced people to kind of maybe reinvent their business model when it relates to theater. Now, as far as Atlanta, what I was seeing, like I said, everything shut down and many people were eager to kind of get back going. So what people have done is kind of started to open back up and do things, but with a limited footprint, spacing for the audience. Some are requiring, you know, all are requiring masks. They're hoping people will be vaccinated. I'm not sure what their different protocols are. So many people are trying to come up with, you know, strategies to kind of begin to offer theater again to the public, you know, but safely. That's kind of like the regional theaters and the equity houses and stuff like that. For the independent theater, I think many of the people that I know are on hold. A lot of the colleagues that I knew who are doing theater have just kind of put a pin in it for now. Mm-hmm. Many of us were hoping, you know, late last year, looking at the top of this year when the vaccines were starting to roll out, we were thinking, okay, by fall, things will start to get back to normal. And then we got that surge, the Delta variant. So right now, I'm not talking to everybody, but a few colleagues that I do have detailed conversations with about these things, we're looking at spring, you know, early summer of 2022 before we believe will be the right time. Because some people are doing it, but audiences are not going out in big numbers. So with the cost of production, I mean, it's difficult already to generate income or to break even or to make a profit from what you do. So to do it in a high-risk environment, it just seems many of us don't believe it's smart right now.
Are you working with the same people? Are you finding that you're working with a different set of people? Because I find that the people I'm working with as an artist, it's a slightly different crew. Some people are out, there are new people coming in. Do you find that your mindset has changed a bit with regard to who you work with?
Because I'm all over the place. Like I said, what I work now, I do a lot of graphic work, and there's some people who like that because I have 7 degrees. So I have accounting, finance, got an MBA. So I really understand how to put together business plans. So doing pitch decks and that kind of stuff and helping people put proposals together, that's one kind of audience or one sort of group that I interface with. There's another group that are doing independent film. There's another group, kind of what we call independent Black theater. That's another group. So, and I'm involved in many different groups. There's some corporate, quote unquote, Hollywood stuff that I do. So I find myself in many different spaces because I'm involved in so many different things in such a way. It changes. I do see some similar faces and I see some things evolving. I know there was one really phenomenal actress who had an elder mother that she was caring for. So during COVID, she completely shut down as an actress. She says, you know, I'm not going to do any work because, you know, I'm a primary caretaker for my mom, and she's elderly and ill, and I don't want to put her at risk. So some people took that. And there was another young lady I know, she says, you know, until COVID is kind of not as much of an issue, I just kind of went on hiatus. So there's a few people I know who've gone on hiatus because of that.
Yeah.
I don't work with the same group. Like I said, every project is different. We'll have a project where I'll pull a team together that makes sense for that project. We finish that project, and then the next project comes, and the same things, you know, different actors, different crew, whether it's film or theater, you know, that kind of thing. I try to work in different disciplines too, in different genres, because sometimes I'm just producing, sometimes I'm writing, sometimes I'm directing. I've even done a little bit of acting, even though on the theater and film side, acting is like a distant fourth. I spend most of the time writing, producing, directing on the theater side.
That's fantastic. I think it is. And I'm wondering also, have you found that doors have opened because of BLM, because of Black Lives Matter? Because it seems that that was very much a big prominent issue for the whole world in 2020 and into 2021. Have you found that doors have opened for you creatively, creative entities, people, other entities that want to use your services or are more, I'd say, amenable to accepting, say, maybe if you're presenting a screenplay, you know, has it changed because of Black Lives Matter?
At the peak, absolutely. Other entities reached out and we were in many conversations, but they haven't matured because, you know, COVID would go down and COVID would go up and COVID would go down and COVID would go up. So we're in a holding pattern. But what I realize and what I think what we do is important is for so long, others have controlled our narrative as Black people. They have told the world who we are. You know, Black women are this and Black men are that. And we see it in the plays, and we've seen it in TV shows. We've seen it in documentaries and movies. And it was an inaccurate, inauthentic, and incomplete story of who we are. So our being able to tell our stories from our point of view is vital. And then we have many generations of stories to catch up on. Because, you know, I know when I went to school, you know, it was slaves and Martin Luther King. That was it. That was the narrative of our contribution to the world. And the Egyptians weren't really Black, you know, kind of thing, was kind of the narrative. And I'm just being honest. I'm not,
you know, believe me, I was in a classroom like that for a period too. Even though I was lucky to go to more liberal education, but yeah, in the beginning it was.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot because others wrote the books and the textbooks and they set the policy and made the rules and on. Cause like I said, I have a lot of education because I thought, okay, I'm going to get this degree and it's going to give me this opportunity. And I kept just getting more and more education. But I would come to these environments in production where there was still an attitude of you're not good enough. But I would see people less qualified, less educated, and less experienced getting opportunities over me. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to play this game with my life. I see it has nothing to do with my ability and my preparedness. Is something else, and I don't have time to fight whoever's battle.
You took control.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I stopped thinking about what it is or what it could be, and I said, you know what? Let me do my own thing. And it was difficult because I had wonderful creative skills, but I didn't know how to run a business. You know, I'm a South Carolina boy, and my family are workers. They will work you under the table. We have a strong work ethic, but there was really no entrepreneurial examples in my family. So when I left corporate America in 2008, I was excited. Yeah, I'm going to go out. I'm going to make this film, television, theater thing happen, blah, blah, blah. From 2008 to 2011, I got my behind handed to me. I didn't know how to run a business. And I had to learn.
I noticed that you have an MBA from University of Phoenix. It's my alma mater as well.
Definitely. And I got finance and accounting from Georgia State. Also studied film and theater at Georgia State. So I got four, I was in four programs there. I had an associate's from St. Leo. I went to electronic school in the military. I'm taking classes at Harvard now, just leadership classes through their edX. And I'm doing a certification through NYU on film and television. I do that because that's what I learned out of necessity. If I'm gonna survive, I have to have access to really good information because over those years, making decisions about your business on bad information, you end up hitting the brick walls. And I hit the brick wall 1,000 times doing it at 1,000 miles an hour. And I said, don't do that. So I learned to depend on me, and I make training a part, a very integral part of the way I function. So every Monday I'm training myself. I'm watching videos, I'm reading books, I'm taking courses. So I'm constantly prepared for the opportunities that are coming my way and you know, be able to grow my business organically.
What I find particularly impressive with you, and I like this kind of thinking, and a lot of creatives don't have this kind of thinking, but you do. It's a frustration to me that there are so few creatives that have this kind of thinking, that you treat your creative endeavors as a business. A lot of creatives don't realize that, yeah, you're an artist, you're whatever, but you're a sole proprietor. When did that dawn on you? I'm just curious, because I noticed that you're creative with an MBA. That's impressive. Yes.
It wasn't gracefully. I'm going to tell you that. Like I said, when you work for someone, you are responsible for that lane. I was a director. My last job, I was a director of marketing for a nonprofit here in Georgia. That's all I had to do. It's just kill that lane. My boss is doing this and other people were doing that. But when you work for yourself, you have to think 360. It's all yours. Mm-hmm. It's everything from finance, accounting, marketing, your technology, your business, your legal, your public relations, all of it. It's like, who's an expert in all of those things? And then when you're just starting out and you don't have the funding, you know, to have those people in place, so you're underfunded and you're understaffed, you either evolve or you die. And I believe that's why so many businesses fail, because it's hard for people to be that adaptable. But I guess I was a very adaptable person. I had to adapt or die. So I adapted. I knew I was a really good director. If I would say there was one thing I am, I'm a director. And I didn't want to be. I wanted to be an actor.
Why did you not want to be a director?
Well, I never really even thought about it, but I'm going to tell you that story. When I was a kid, I saw the show, and these little kids were on this like Saturday morning show that would come on before the cartoons. I said, Mom, I want to do that. And being in a small kind of industrial town, it was out of reach, you know, in the early 70s. That's in California somewhere. So it wasn't realistic. And my mom, boom, she pushed me through science and mathematics, which I did pretty good in. Mm-hmm. Long story short, when I went to the military, I went to electronic school. But then when I got to Atlanta, I ran into a young lady who was heavily involved in the arts, and it just ignited that fire. In that journey, I started off acting because that's what I wanted to do. And I just jumped in with both feet and just went for it. And this is 1993, mind you.
It's a while ago.
On that journey, there was a director I work with. He says, you're a director. I'm like, no, I want to act. I want to act. He says, no, you are a director. I'm like, no, I want to act. I really want to act. And long story short, the first time I directed something, I knew it. I'm like, oh, wow, this is it. It was like when in The Matrix, when Keanu Reeves saw The Matrix for the first time, I was like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. It felt so organic. I mean, I worked my chops off to be good as an actor, only to make marginal progress forward. I barely put an effort as a director, and I was just killing it. It was instinctual, and I was like, where does that come from? And I realized I was that young kid in the backyard on Saturday mornings building worlds. You know, I would take my Hot Wheels cars and my Star Wars men and my G.I. Joe soldiers and just play and just building these storylines and characters and all of this. I think that's what contributed to my being an instinctual director. I was cultivating and nurturing that most of my life without even knowing it. And the first time I directed something, it seemed like it just all just kind of fell in line. And I didn't know why I would be so good at that when I worked so much harder doing other things. But then I realized, I said, wait a minute, you know, this could trace back all the way to that. And I believe that's where it originated. It's just playing as a kid and just using that imagination and creating these storylines and making things happen that way. Another part of it, my mother, which contributed to my being a producer, my mother was the one in the family who always planned everything. So she was the one that brought the family together for barbecues and this holiday event and that holiday event. And I was her mini me. Hey, go put this stuff in the car. Go set these tables up. Go take this trash out. So I was always there to help her organize and coordinate. So when it came for me to be a project manager, I had been doing that for years also, because anytime she'd go to the church and there was a big event at the church, I was right there. I had to be right there with her. So in many ways, the environment I came from trained me to be a director and a producer from a very young age. Let me tell you, as a kid, I didn't like it at the time. I was like, I always got to do this stuff, you know? But I thank God for it because, again, I mean, I'm really good at organizing too. And I didn't realize that until I saw how poorly others did it. I'm like, wow, how do they not know this? And I realized I had been doing events with my mom for years, planning, making sure people got the invite, setting things up, taking things down. And we were workers. My mom would be the last one, you know, first one in, last one out. That's me as a producer. I'm right on set, making sure everything's in place. Everybody's gone. I'm shutting everything down, you know, making sure people got the information, just all of these things. And my mom would know certain things about, oh, your uncle likes this and my sister likes this. And, this part of the family, like she understood each of them and tried to create a situation where each of them would be happy. So that's me on set as a producer, because I have to communicate with my director of photography one way, the actors another way, the lighting guy or girl a different way. It's like as a producer, if I got 20 people on set, I got to speak 20 different languages.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. You're dealing with a lot of different personalities. Do you find that you have a peaceful set? Do you have a peaceful production? Because so often you hear these stories about, I'm not going to get what kind of stories you have. I've heard some interesting stories about people involved in productions working with different people. And I think also a director and a producer in my world, okay, someone that can kind of keep the peace when a lot of people are working. There's a lot of moving parts.
Not to pat myself on the back, but my sets run well.
You can go ahead, pat yourself. It's all right.
Because here's what I know. The number one thing that will destroy a creative production is ego. For one person in that production to come and think they're more important than anybody else is suicide for that project, period. It's destructive. Why? Yeah, of course, they're lanes. And if you know, such and such, this is what they do, and let them, there's one director, there's one DP, there's one person playing this role. Everybody stays in their lane and do it well, but everybody's important. That's what I learned the hard way, because, hey, I'm a really good director, but I need a good editor. I need good light. I need good sound. I need good actors. I need a good script. How can I show the world what I can do? Because I need all these other pieces. So that's what I said, failing, figuring these things out. I set the tone at the top. Even though I'm in charge, I'm financing stuff, that kind of thing, I will clean toilets. I will take out the trash. I lead from the back, the front, and the middle.
It's very humble.
Exactly. I'm involved in the process. I'm committed to it. My overarching goal in the culture that I try to create on my productions, the ones that I'm originating, the one that I'm managing, I want to put everybody in a position to do their best work, because that's the only way we're going to compete. You have some phenomenal talents. Not just in here in Atlanta, but all over the world. So all of those people are going after the Netflix and the Hulus and trying to get their content out there, or want to have their shows in the big theaters and have audience pay attention. So if you're coming with some okay or mediocre stuff, you can forget it, because audiences have some really phenomenal choices and they're going to gravitate towards those good choices. So if you can't get your ducks in a row internally, it's going to be hard for you to compete in the marketplace externally. So that's why we don't tolerate it. I don't come in with ego. I don't come in with ego like, oh, I'm the king of this castle. It's like, no. All right, guys, what do we need to do to make this production work and put out the best work possible? And I'm learning, ING, to spend time with those people to learn how they work, how they create, how they like to communicate. And you build that into the system so you can be successful. This is new for me, because in 2015, I wasn't that astute, but it got a little better in 2016, a little better in 17, and then 18, 19. So now I'm at a place is like, okay, yeah, we have the rhythm now. I think the business model is tight, it's polished, and by the grace of God, we're getting ready to put out some amazing work. Right now, I got projects booked all the way through 2022.
Wow.
Yeah, as soon as I'm finishing one, I'm editing one now on the film side. We go into production on another one next month, and then another one follows that. And it just back to back. As soon as I finish one, we roll into another. Right now, they're all filmed. Theater, I could put a pin in theater for now because we got to see what COVID's going to do. I know we can put together a good show, but will anybody show up?
Yeah.
Money for venue and actors and all of that stuff and time, and nobody shows up. It's disappointing. It's not a good business move, you know?
It seems the reality is always acknowledging that COVID could change whatever your trajectory is. COVID will change your plans. It sounds like you have things so organized that I can imagine that you have like a plan B and a plan C for everything that you do. Is that a fact? Am I correct when I say that?
Yeah, in some ways, yes. And there's a philosophical thing to that.
Tell me.
From a philosophical standpoint, I have no plan B. I'm going to make it work because, like I said, I have degrees in accounting and finance and I have MBA. I could probably get a job making a lot more consistent money, per se, doing something with all the expertise and experience that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so easy to lean on that because I tried that before. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to make this money in corporate America and I'm going to go out and make my films and plays. But corporate America required so much of me, I didn't have time to do any of that. You're working 60 hours a week. You take care of house and family. There's nothing left. So I'm giving what I feel the best part of me, the leftover time, a couple hours. That's it. You're never going to make any real progress. You know, so that's when I went full time. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it and fail at it and say, hey, because I don't want to be 50, 60, 70 saying I wish I would have, could have. So that's why I left corporate America in 2008. I was like, you know, I'm going to go for it. If I fail, I can always go back and get a job. But since 2008, this is all I do. So that's why I said I have no plan B in that respect.
2008.
Yeah, 2008. That's when it was kind of ramping up when you met me during the James Brown things. I was starting to do a lot of little things. I was integrating some of them then, but you know, I just kind of peeled off and did my own thing. But the other part of that, out of lack of resources, lack of manpower, I've had so many productions fail or fall short because of that. Oh man, we got this great film, but we need an editor. And editors are $75 to $100 and some an hour. We don't have money. So we got a good project, but the editing sucks. Or, you know, we got great actors and hey, I'm a pretty good director, but we don't have a good script. There were so many missing pieces to make a play, to make a good short film or something like that. So over time, I learned to be a better producer. I learned to be a better screenwriter. I learned how to edit. I learned how to do graphic design and lights and sound, et cetera, et cetera. So I pretty much can do everything right now from concept to completion. It's taken me years to get to that point. So on my production, if something were to fall short, I can jump in there and keep that machine running temporarily.
And it is a well-oiled machine, it sounds like. Do you have a website? Can you tell the audience your website in case they want to, and your contact information in case they want to get in touch with you?
Well, right now, that's the beauty of COVID with all this downtime. I'm reimagining. My website is bluebistrocreative.com.
Bluebistrocreative.com.
But it's under construction now. I'm revamping the whole thing and we're getting ready to launch whole new site and whole new set of branding. Starting at the top of 2021. So we're spending now all the way to the rest of the year, tightening everything down. Upgrading reels, photography, content. We're just building everything up and polishing everything down because with so many things coming back to back pre-COVID, you know, a lot of little things get missed. That's the life of a small business owner. But since with all this downtime, I said, well, let me take that time to kind of polish up some of these things and you know, kick the dust off some of these things in this huge to-do list that I had internally. So like we've had the website and you know, it's not a great reflection of what we could do. And I said, well, that's my fault. But I never have time because I go to this project, from that project to that project to that project. Who has time to manage a website? So now we're taking the time to do those kinds of things and really get it to where it's reflective of who we are and what we do. And then our reels and a whole bunch of other things, just all those little things that it takes, you know, to manage a business successfully. So it's not just about, you know, hey, going out and do the good work. There has to be full infrastructure tied to that.
I see that you know, even though to me, a website is always under construction. That's what I believe. But what I do see is I've been looking at you on your LinkedIn page, Anthony R. Page, MBA. That was very impressive, because if anybody wants to know about the whole dynamic of you, I mean, I see it there.
And if you put in my name, Anthony R. Page, and that's P-A-G-E, all the social media stuff will come up. We have like 10, we have 10 Facebook pages. We have one LinkedIn page, and we're on Twitter. We have 3 Instagram pages. So all of that stuff will come up. We were able to keep those updated because it's short. It's like bang, bang. And they make the infrastructure. We just drop content because we're content creators. We're good at creating content, but managing it, the user interface, all of that kind of stuff. When you do your own website, you have to put all of that stuff in place.
Right.
We're working on that. But if you Google Blue Bistro Creative, a lot will come up on us because we've become better at using search engine optimization and all that kind of stuff. And if you put in my name, the same thing. We've been very intentional about making sure that we're integrating with their algorithms and understanding how they work. So that determines how we post and when we post and that kind of thing. When I say we, I'm mostly driving it, but I do have people for specialty things that'll come in and help me do certain things.
I think that you've done an outstanding job, and I'll say you've changed and evolved like dramatically since I worked with you in 2006, where I feel like I was just like a little gosling back there, you know, back then. But you did something very, very big back then. And I can't discount it. It was very, very impressive. I met you through Lucinda J. Clark and Lucy Craft Laney Museum with the James Brown Visual Soul Expedition, which was a worldwide thing. And, you know, that was nothing to sneeze at. And that was in 2006. And look at you now. So like I say, I'm going to have my audience hear your website again. It is bluebistrocreative.com. My motto is that all websites are always under construction, because the person that is actually galvanizing it is always under construction, as we are as human beings. And I'll direct my audience to check out your LinkedIn page. If you go to linkedin.com, you can find Anthony R. Page.
Like, I have an Anthony Page IG and an Anthony R. Page, the Blue Bistro IG, and same thing with Facebook. You'll see all of that comes up. Because we separate it, like we have one dedicated Facebook page of all of our graphic design work, so you can see our graphic design history. Another for all of our photographic history. Then we have another dedicated to all of our theater activity, and another dedicated to all the film activity. Then there's another for my acting activity. So they're separated, and then I have one merged called Blue Bistro Creative overall, where everything is there. But if you wanted to kind of compartmentalize a little bit, if somebody said, hey, what are you doing in graphics? Instead of filtering through all that stuff, trying to see what my graphic design is, I can just send them directly to that one graphic design page, and they'll get a focused look at what that is, or a focused look at what I'm doing in film, or a focused look at what I'm doing in theater and that kind of thing. So that's why we have so many different pages, because we know, you know, people have a short attention span, and if we got a whole bunch of stuff that's irrelevant to them, it'll lose people's interest. It's like, hey, I want to know what you're doing in film, and they go to my one page and they got all this graphic design and photography stuff, they can be like, okay, I don't see a lot of film stuff here. But if I send them directly to my film page, it's all that, nothing else. You see what I mean? So we've learned those things, you know, we've figured those things out over time, you know, to understand how to best build that relationship with our audience, because our theater audience and our film audiences are very different.
I can imagine that. I can imagine that, being a New Yorker and all. And I want to say also that I'm definitely looking forward to hearing this interview and sharing it, because you've given a lot of great information, and you're a star, Anthony. And I know you're not trying to be a star, but you are trying to do what you do. And I think that what you're doing to promote Black theater arts is outstanding. And I look forward to having you on Energy Stoners Cafe again.
Absolutely. I want to thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate, you know,
pleasure is mine,
getting an opportunity to speak to you and your audiences. So,
yeah, and I'm so glad that we've sort of like converged again after all these years. I'm very pleased, and I love to see people do well, and I'm really happy to see you doing well. And I'm going to invite you back, and the audience, I'm going to say goodbye to the audience for this time. And I'm looking forward to having you back again, Anthony R. Page. And also for my audience, I thank you so much for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe. And there'll always be another guest. And I look forward to presenting the most interesting people I can find on the planet. Good night. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.